Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. So thank you for being here. Appreciate you showing up. So, good afternoon. It's a beautiful Sunday here in Colorado. Gorgeous, really. Like, I should be outside right now, but I had too many things that I had weighing in the background in my subconscious that I needed to take care of. And with the coming of spring, I needed to do some deep cleaning. So I spent the last 4 hours scrubbing my house. I scrubbed walls, I scrubbed doors. I even cleaned out my fucking bathtub, which that's probably like hands down the worst cleaning task in the whole house to me is either the oven or the bathtub. Like the bathtub just gets gross and I hate the soaps you use on it. But my task is accomplished, but now more than half the day is gone, and I'm not sure if I'm going to get outside today. But that's all right. So this week, I want to discuss kind of a darkish topic that shouldn't have to be. As human beings, we have this light facet of our person, and we also have a darkness, a shadow in the Jungian sense. But we have this polarity of pulls, of motivations towards and away from things based on pleasure or aversion, you know? And so all these different pulls and contexts, environmentally and otherwise, tend to make a defensive creature within us. And we have all these sort of defense mechanisms that we use in order to help soothe ourselves or to help deter damage and to take less, you know, collateral. And so what happens when we have this multifaceted person that is us is that we often find ourselves making mistakes. And when we make mistakes, we feel guilt. Guilt and shame have a nuance of difference that I may or may not be able to explain today. But shame is kind of like a social conditioning that we use in order to train one another, whereas guilt is sort of like a tool that we use to train ourselves in our own ethical moral complex. So we all develop very different ethical systems and cores. And yet again, this is based upon that environmental interplay between us and it. But I would have to assume then as well that every single person has a variance in this guilt system. You know, maybe some people have a surplus of guilt, and there might be things like generational guilt or evolutionary guilt. I know I've read some reports that show that epigenetically stressors in like our ancestors can affect our own genetic core. Like I've heard that like smoking affects our chromosomal DNA and that this can then have mutations that affect our children. So there's things that we can do now that will affect the life of our futures. And so we have all these different ways that we hold this idea of guilt. And I've been thinking a lot about it this week because maybe part of it is just growing up in that church systems. Like I grew up in the South, as I've told you all before. And growing up around certain types of churches, and I'm not going to say that all churches are bad. And I don't think that the faith of Christianity is bad in any way on the surface. I think that some people abuse power and organizational structures. But embedded within Christianity is this natural guilt that is implied. You know, and that's what sin is this part of our humanness that we automatically are born with that is assumed to be bad. You know, and we have to We have to be forgiven for our sins that we have from birth, you know? Like, and that's a very guilty system. And that's sort of where I think I inherited a lot of my feelings about self-guilt, you know? Like, when I was growing up, my grandparents used to tell me in detail how if I wasn't good, I was going to go to hell. And I know I'm not the only one who's had experiences like that, that is going to affect how you feel about these organizations of faith. And yet again, I want to caution anyone against, you know, generalizing what one organization has done to all of them, because there are good people out there in any faith. Like, it's just all about being careful about how you give yourself over to other people, which is a necessary component of spirituality, I think, is the community of it. So I had this strong sense of guilt that I felt from childhood, you know, and now I look at my own son and I see a lot of these remnants of these past events and that made me in him. And part of that is my own impact. It's the things that I'm doing in a parenting style that are misapplied over and over and over again. You know, when we have intentions as parents, we want to help and we want to do things for what seems like the best purpose, but often we make mistakes. And so how do we reconcile the feeling of guilt after we've made a mistake? And how do we do it in a healthy way where we can make it a growing opportunity and we can learn from it? Because being stuck in a guilt cycle where we have begun to bludgeon ourselves, like we have this like whip, you know, I don't know if any of you have ever seen the movie The Da Vinci Code, where there's that weird albino blonde guy with the funky eyes, and he's got that flailing whip with all kinds of sharp things, and he's sitting in front of the mirror and just whipping himself in the back, you know. I always think of that self-flagellation in a metaphorical psychic sense and what we do to ourselves all the time. And it can become unfunctionable, and it can become a hindrance to our organism and to our social systems when we break down like a gear that is no longer hitting the next gear, and so the whole system starts to get all fuggy. Like, it doesn't help to be stuck in it, but it does help to feel the feeling and notice it as an indicator of the situation so that we know that, hey, this happened, you know? And so, like, in parenting, a lot of the times I get stuck in the anger trap where I take situations way too personally as an adult. And as in last week's episode, when I spoke about how we may be adults, but our children are not. They are independent little creatures that have their own sense of frame of reference, you know? And so I've taken something personally as an adult in a situation where two adults are not present, and then I find myself being angry, you know? And I think this is how a lot of misparenting happens with a lot more than just me, you know, is that sense of self-righteousness in the situation that is non-existent. You know, when we step back as a parent, we realize that a little bit of distance, there's always a way to knuckle the situation into a learning opportunity. And it doesn't just apply to our children, it applies to ourselves too, you know. So once we've made the mistake, the customary feelings and physical reactions come. You know, and for me, I always kind of feel like a drop in my stomach, kind of like an elevator going up, or like a car hitting a dip in the road, or like when you fall really fast, there's like a sense of vertigo. But that sense of stomach compaction is linked to my spinal cord, and there's kind of like a feeling in my spine too, where like my shoulder blades crimp together, you know. And this took awareness to notice these things and these feelings, because I think a lot of the times we can go through these physical reactions and we could start the catalyst of this thing, and we don't really realize it's happening, and then we get swept away and we're completely entangled in it. Whereas I can try to use these feelings and notice them, and I can try to notice the feeling come in, and that helps the awareness of the situation become solid and concrete. And that's necessary in order to have a full perspective on what's happening. When we're swept away and when we're playing the part, we can't really see what's happening because we're an actor in our own part, our own role. And so it's very important just to be able to have a sense of your own physical response, because I don't have enough data empirically, and I'm not a scientist for one, to be able to say that this is how you're going to feel. But I want you to consider deeply watching these physical feelings, even though like they feel bad sometimes, because like I hate that feeling of guilt, and it's a major motivator for me to try to be honest and have integrity. And like, even though it kills me sometimes, and I know it puts gray hair in my beard, you know, it's also a part of why I have such a firm moral compass for myself and for my loved ones and how I want to treat people. So that's how the feeling mutates and transmutates into a healthier response, and I use it to grow. So like, here's an example of a recent mistake I made. My son has been having a lot of accidents over like the last like almost 9 months. It's been a very long extended time. And for probably about 3 or 4 months, my father and my mother have both been telling me to take him to a doctor and to be physically checked out because there might be a physical origin for it. But selfishly, I took it in my own hands to judge the situation, and I decided that it was a behavior and that this was a symptom of our maladaption to each other, and I had personified it. I took him personally here, you know. And from that point on, he was acting against me, and we were stuck in this rut of tension, and we were constantly fighting over it, and I was doing nothing about it because I expected it to fix itself on its own. And so 2 weeks ago, I decided to go and take him to the doctor, and we got an x-ray. And on the x-ray, it showed that he had a compaction in his gut and that he actually was completely full of shit, which is something I knew all along. But like, this compaction was making it so that he had no control over any of his fecal responses. And so he was literally had no control over it and was just having a sickness. You know, he was having an issue, an ordeal. And this whole time I had treated it as a behavior. And months ago, I could have taken the advice of those who were wiser than me, and I could have gone and tried to rectify the situation, and we could have started something months ago. Like, that's a major mistake for me, and I made the wrong call, and I mistreated him, and like, I owe him because of how I acted and how I mishandled my responsibility of him to take care of him. Like, so I've been feeling that heavily, you know, and over the last 3 days, he's been on a laxative and it hasn't been working very well. So I've been carrying a lot of anxiety because I'm not sure how bad it is and when and how and what's going to work. You know, all the big W questions of that fuse into anxiety and concern about one's capabilities and capacity, you know. But I'm not going to let it drag me down, and I haven't been depressed about it, and I've just tried to accept that I did take him, and I did do it, and so I am helping fix the situation, and whether or not it's late, I'm not going to carry any excessive guilt that's going to make me a worse parent, because if I feel down and if I feel tense, then I'm going to mishandle any other future situations with him. You know, you see how all that ties together? Do you see how that like is attached? We have to take every single thought opportunity as a time to grow a good seed. And as humans, we have this need for growing and for doing better, you know? And I feel like I've turned this bus around. I feel like I'm starting to move in a better direction for my family. And that's growth, even though I made a massive mistake. They can coexist. They're necessary sometimes for a mistake to happen. You know, like I had a friend who has been clean for quite a while, and I texted him last weekend. He's like, yeah, I'm okay. You know, family's good. But like, you know, I binged on Xannies for like 2 weeks, and you know, I feel like shit now, and I'm really not happy with myself. And I told him a similar thing that I'm trying to tell myself now and you, that you can't beat yourself up over it. It's a self-repeating cycle, and the shittier you feel about yourself, the more mistakes and the worse you're gonna feel. Like, so you have to turn nickel into gold. You have to alchemize. You have to be a magician. You have to be special, which you are. We all are. We're a speck of life on this planet. We're part of the intrinsic loops and spirals of isness that is our world. And it's exciting a lot of the time. So just some stuff to think about, stuff I'm going to continue thinking about. We're all, you included, especially unique individuals. But a lot of the human experience that's endemic to history and to the future and to now is a communal act. And so we all have a lot of similarities and a lot of similar responses. And so we can look at these systems and we can try to be scientific about it and try to be helpful to the system because we're in this. You know, but at the same time, we can recognize the component of ourselves that may or may not be strictly biological, that spirit, that psyche. There's an inner world of being that also needs love and attention and care, just like a garden. And so don't forsook the inner realm, the inner microcosm, for your outer realm as well. And consider the parallels between interpersonal relationships on the outside and how you might even be treating parts of yourself within those same mirrored intrapersonal circumstances. So, have love for you. Have faith in you. Just think about that. So, I've been thinking a lot about the fourth dimension. And I watched this very interesting video about this kid who had, he looked like he was probably 15, and he was in a very, very upbeat and physical way. I was explaining this concept of a fourth dimensional being. And I wish I knew the name of the video. I can't really explain it well without the visual, but just if there was a fourth dimensional being, which is kind of like these entities that are described in psychedelic experiences that I'm not completely convinced are separate beings and may in fact even just be facets of our own inner microcosm. Like, all of psychedelia to me has been a argument sometimes, but often a conversation between me and me. And all the weird shit has always been phenomena of me. You know, I think that's kind of what happens. It's like a chemical sensory deprivation. And when you have your psyche start manifesting on the outside, when you look, that's your visuals, that's your hallucinations. Like, so maybe there could be this fourth dimensional concept, but I'm not even convinced. And so it got me thinking about how far the purview of science can reach. And I was discussing this with a friend last night, and he was telling me about, you know, how quantum physics had become to start to think about these other parallel dimensions, and then that's what made me bring up, you know, fourth dimension kid. And I was like, you know, how does anybody know? How could we ever know any of these kind of things? You know, like, we can make chemicals because we understand chemistry to a point that even though we can't see the molecules that chemistry produces, like nobody's ever seen a neurotransmitter, nobody's ever seen a molecule of methamphetamine or anything, but we can use our like models to chemically produce anything even though we can't see them. So that's a counter argument to what I'm producing here about being able to functionally make things that we can't, shouldn't be able to think about, that shouldn't rightfully be within our reason. Yet, some of these ideas, like afterlife and spirits and aliens to an extent, you know, like, there should be more physical proof. And if there's not any sort of physicality, then we have to approach it subjectively. It doesn't disprove it by a long shot, you know, and I'm not trying to disprove, like, you know, a ghost or a spirit. I'm just saying that subjectively, all I can know about the afterlife and the spirit and, like, time loops and warp space and, like, all these sort of futuristic thought experiments, these thought salads, like, all I can ever know is my own subjective thought process of it, you know, like, I feel like they're a little bit more removed even from the chemistry example I was trying to say. You know, like, there's a step above that even where it just becomes very murky. Like, the concept of God. Nobody's ever going to be able to test for God. You know, in my own subjective experience of God, even though I can use it to be loving and that might affect others, you know, my God, I'm not convinced can ever talk to you. You know, you might have your own perception of a God. You know, like the universal God out there that has the ability to touch all of us, I'm not completely convinced of. And I can't disprove it either. You know, but it's very murky territory. And so when I hear about quantum physicists proving another dimension, I'm highly skeptical. You know, like, it brings me back to religious principles and philosophical principles and things like the Tao Te Ching, where it says that the Tao that can be spoken is not the Tao. You know, like, some of these ideas are unthinkable, and it takes the paradox of not thinking about them where we can actually conceive of them, which is incredibly difficult to do. But shouldn't stop anybody from trying. And I'm not saying these scientists should quit their jobs, and I think there should still be quantum physicists out there studying their dimensions and all their weird spaces and all their strings and times. I think it's all valid, and we should never stop investigating these thoughts and these reasonable experiments and all these different trains. Like, but we can never take what's valid for us and supplant somebody else's validity and try to put our own thought forms onto another person. That's where it becomes an issue. And that's where organizations of the past and kingdoms and, you know, authoritarian leaderships have often raped societies and individuals. So think freely for you. Inspire others by being curious in what you're curious about. But don't ever try to take somebody else's beliefs from them. I'm going to try not to. All right. Well, that's about most of my yarn. I want to do a little bit of quotations, and then I'm going to go fetch out. But just very grateful as I sit here today. And I'm always appreciative to have these moments with you. And I hope you've had a lovely week. So, I'll be right back. All right. Firstly, I'm reading from John Stuart Mill's collection. I have like a bunch of his little essays, and this is an essay on utilitarianism, which I have an episode about utility back in the backlogs if you would like to investigate. I'm not going to go dig too much into it here, but he's talking about pleasures in this passage I'm about to read to you, and I found it quite curious because he's talking about this stratification of pleasures, like there's higher pleasures and lower pleasures and things that are more pulling. And this is just his little digression about it. It must be admitted, however, that utilitarian writers in general have placed the superiority of mental over bodily pleasures chiefly in the greatest permanency, safety, and costliness. Of the former, that is, in their circumstantial advantages rather than in their intrinsic nature, And on all these points, utilitarians have fully proved their case, but they might have taken the other, and as it may be called, higher ground, with entire consistency. It is quite compatible with the principle of utility to recognize the fact that some kinds of pleasure are more desirable and more valuable than others. It would be absurd that while, in estimating all other things, quality is considered as well as quantity, the estimation of pleasures should be supposed to depend on quantity alone. If I'm asked what I mean by a difference in quality and pleasures, or what makes one pleasure more valuable than another, merely as a pleasure, except its being greater in amount, there is but one possible answer. Of two pleasures, if there be one to which all, or almost all of who have experienced it, both give a decided preference, irrespective of any feeling or moral obligation to prefer it, that is the more desirable pleasure. If one of the two is, by those who are competently acquainted with both, placed so far above the other that they prefer it, even though knowing it to be attended with a greater amount of discontent, and would not resign it for any quantity of the other pleasure which their nature is capable of, we are justified in ascribing to the preferred enjoyment and a superiority in quality, so far outweighing quantity as to render it, in comparison, of small account. Now it is an unquestionable fact that those who are equally acquainted with and equally capable of appreciating and enjoying both do give a most marked preference to the manner of existence which employs the higher faculties. Few human creatures would consent to be changed into any of the lower animals for a promise of the fullest allowance of a beast's pleasure. No intelligent human being would consent to be a fool. No instructed person would be an ignoramus. No person of feeling and conscience would be selfish and base. Even though they should be persuaded that the fool, the dunce, or the rascal is better satisfied with his lot than they are with theirs, they would not resign what they possess more than he, for the most complete satisfaction of all the desires which they have in common with him. So, it's kind of a yarn. He's British. But the main concept that I pulled from that is that there are different types of pleasures in the world. And that he says that most people wouldn't want to be turned into an animal. And I guess probably some people are out there that would think that that is advantageous to their happiness. You know, but for me, the thought of being like any animal that's not me, I think it would blow my fucking mind. I think I'd be insane if my consciousness was just downloaded into any other creature. I think it would just fuck me up. You know, I think we're only compatible with our own frames of systems. You know, and that's kind of where I kind of agree with what he's saying, you know. But like every philosophy and every system, you know, you can't always just take all of it. So there's always going to be some dirt and some good. But for the most part, I do really like this guy. So that's why I like to share it with you. All right. The next one is my copy of The Psychedelic Experience, which is like a Americanized, psychedelicized version of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, where they use it as like a roadmap for describing the different states of consciousness that certain people can achieve under certain dosages of these chemicals. And so this is from the first chapter where they're describing liberation, and the writers were Timothy Leary, Ralph Metzner, and Richard Alpert, and Ram Dass. Timothy Leary is the guy who said, tune in, drop out. You know, if you're ever having doubts, turn off your mind to float downstream. Another Learyism. And he had a lot of bad press, and he got his ass kicked out of Harvard, and he had a lot of other reasons why probably huge segments that didn't like the counterculture back in the 60s and the 70s probably still have an ill taste in their mouth. Like, if I were to bring this up with my dad or my grandparents, they'd probably think he's an idiot. You know, my dad thought Ram Dass was a cult leader, and so was Alan Watts, and that's blasphemous, since neither of them even really had a following. It's more of a conglomeration of people with like-minded goals, whereas a cult usually has some sort of authoritarian goal, some charismatic pull where people have to give something away. You know, you give away your faith, you give away your beliefs to this leader. You know, and I never saw that in the frame of a lot of these teachers and these thinkers from the 60s. I'm still very fond of a lot of these people. So here goes, just a little bit. Liberation is the nervous system devoid of mental conceptual activity. The mind in its conditioned state, that is to say, when limited to the words and ego games, is continuously in thought formation activity. The nervous system in a state of quiescence, alert, awake, but not active, is comparable to what Buddhists call the highest state of jhana, deep meditation, when still united to a human body. The conscious recognition of the clear light induces an ecstatic condition of consciousness, such as saints and mystics of the West have called illumination. The first sign is the glimpsing of the clear light of reality, the infallible mind of the pure mystic state. This is the awareness of an energy transformation with no imposition of mental category. The duration of the state varies with the individual. It depends upon experience, security, trust, preparation, and the surroundings. And those who have had even a little practical experience of this tranquil state of non-game awareness, and then those who have happy games, this state can last from 30 minutes to several hours. In this state, realization of what mystics call the ultimate truth is possible, provided that sufficient preparation has been made by the person beforehand. Otherwise, he cannot benefit now and must wander on into lower and lower conditions of hallucinations, as determined by his past games, until he drops back to routine reality. It is important to remember that the consciousness expansion process is the reverse of the birth process, birth being the beginning of the game life and the ego loss experience being a temporary ending of this game life. But in both, there is a passing from one state of consciousness into another. And just as an infant must wake up and learn from the experience the nature of this world, so likewise a person at the moment of consciousness expansion must wake up in this new brilliant world and become familiar with its own peculiar conditions. Fucking fantastic book. I love their writing style. I'm glad I read the because I started with the traditional Tibetan book. I read a translation of the Bardo Thordo. But having got that like super esoteric Buddhist framework in my head, it's a lot easier for me to track this one. And maybe it would be easier for other people to do that in inverse and start with Leary's and Alpert's psychedelic experience and then moving on to the esoteric old school Tibetan book. There's a lot more relatable for me when it comes to this one, for sure. All right. I hope you guys have a loving week, and I hope you take care of yourself and those who you care about. And I hope to see you next week. I'm gonna go grab O, and we're gonna be out.
Hello, Ask O is here.
Woo!
So,
hey, before you go, can I just say something to you in front of everybody here?
Yeah.
I'm really sorry that I didn't take you to the doctor earlier, and I really should have been more thoughtful and taken you there a while before it got to this point. And so I want to pay more attention in the future, okay?
Okay.
And I love you.
Love you.
All right, you can go. Talk about whatever you want.
Okay, can you do the password? Okay, sorry.
What are you doing?
Sorry, everybody. So, can I tell you something about comfort?
Okay, what's comfort?
You might know as comfort is like a pillow or a blanket, like a really fluffy blanket or something.
Like a soft one?
Yeah. So comfort is actually a good feeling of soft things.
You like soft things?
Yes, I do.
I like that you switched your shirt around.
Including stuffed animals, soft shirts,
socks.
Okay.
Soft socks.
Yes, they're soft.
Soft.
Yes.
Okay. Soft eyeglasses, soft toilet covers.
Maybe. This maybe. Okay.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.